All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. We've reconvened once more for a One Piece with a Lime podcast episode.
Yeah. Oh, we're doing this beforehand. Yeah. We're here. Hi. I'm here, Mom.
Hello, friends.
I made it barely.
And with that rousing introduction, I will now read the summary.
Okay.
Fisher Tiger and Queen Otohime, the heroes of Fishman Island, their tales are deeply intertwined with rage and tragic irony. We conclude the story of Fisher Tiger in these episodes as he returns Koala, the young and formerly enslaved human girl, to her home island to be reunited with friends and family alike. Despite Fisher's demons and hatred for humankind, he and the rest of the Sun Pirates completed their quest to bring her home. Unfortunately, it was not the happy ending they imagined, as the population of the island heard word of their arrival and cooperated with the government to have the fishmen ambushed. In this attack, Fisher Tiger is gravely wounded, to the point he meets his ultimate demise. We learn that Fisher carried an unspeakable rage for the human race that he shouldered from the rest of his men, and his rage kept him from overcoming his pride as he lay dying on the operating table, cursing and refusing the blood that may be used to save him, as it belonged to none other than a human. Otohime fought back on their homeland, her arduous battle against the will and fear of the island's people. As news spread of Fisher Tiger's passing, the wounds caused by the worst of humankind could only continue to scar the relationship that the queen wished to heal. Nevertheless, she continued on, convincing her people, until one day a celestial dragon washed ashore to retrieve his property, the slaves that were once set free. The queen intervened and guaranteed safe passage to this celestial dragon back to the land of Mary Joie, and as a show of good faith, decided she would even go with him to return to his home and receive favor from the celestial dragons in their efforts to move the island to the surface. She hoped that this single gesture would be enough to encourage the people of Fishman Island to give a chance to the surface world and its people, so that the two races may sit one day under the same sun. Upon her return, she is met with joy and praise as the inhabitants of the island all line up to place their names into the basket. We all wish to see the surface world, no matter the risks. But in another twist of fate, on their soil, she was struck down with a weapon in broad daylight by none other than a human. Fisher Tiger and Queen Otohime, their stories show us that change comes at a price. Sometimes a price too great to overcome. Perhaps the promise of a better future will never come to pass. Or instead, perhaps, it might one day come with the will of kindness of the ones that follow in their footsteps.
Nice. Get choked up. I know, man, dude. Like, I'm sad. I was sad.
I know, dude.
All right, so I will say, I already have, like, a couple of notes. I'm so happy. I didn't know how good we have it getting some of this cut down. Because can I level with you? These episodes do not hit quite as hard with the general Toei pacing at, like, front and center. These episodes slap when you get rid of some of the fluff that they fucking milk in the anime. My God, I was bawling. I loved everything about what we got this week. It was actually super fucking fire.
Yeah. It was a good bad time this week.
It was a good bad time. That's a way to put it.
We do have our resident new guy. Christian, how did you enjoy this week? You're the only one who hasn't seen these episodes.
What a loaded question.
What a loaded question indeed.
These episodes were enjoyable. Very much so.
Good.
For
why does
some
that feel like a bad
unfortunate reasons?
I felt like
because
a bad word.
Ahead,
like,
Justin,
they're enjoyable. I'm like, why does it feel like you're trying to slander the show? Oh no, no.
You
I'm sensitive.
I am not Devin. All right. Let's.
I think the narrative choices here, it's not about slander. It's that it's really hard to put into words exactly what kind of emotions you put yourself through when dealing with the tragedy of Fisher Tiger and Otohime in these episodes.
That's
right. I mean, it's like you don't really know how to put it. You're happy to experience it and to be exposed to it. But at the same time, you're like, yikes, this makes me hate reality right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all so I mean, we already know where their stories come to end eventually, but to experience the story and the just absolute tragedy of it all, I think is I feel very, I don't know, conflicted about, like, you know, just in the world speaking about what everything that's going on. You know,
yes,
it almost, you know, I'm not going to sympathize with a villain, but like seeing all of these things, you realize where what people like Hody and Arlong went through to end up the people that they are, were, in Arlong's mm-hmm, case mm-hmm. anyway. So I don't know. It's just it's really good storytelling when you can leave a viewer and ending up in a state like I feel right now.
Yeah.
So I'm with your thing about One Piece being a lot better than the actual pacing of the show. I'm glad too that we've made this decision, because I don't think I would have been able to tolerate too much fluff in between the occurrences of what we did watch here. Because if there was too much extra bullshit in between, I might have come to hate it.
It honestly, it detracts a little bit. And I mean, you expect that when you're talking about pacing. You want the story to be told in like the cleanest format possible, whatever, whatever. But Toei has this problem where they refuse to take breaks. They want to, you know, make sure that they're constantly being weekly. They don't want to do seasonal anime. So at the end of the day, the only option is to patch shit out. I am very thankful that we were able to experience this, especially for you in this set, because I would say it still hits. There's just something about being able to experience it like all the way through. No stops, no restarts, no fucking 4 minutes at the start of the next episode devoted to a flashback of the previous episode. You just eat it all up, all in a single sitting. Mm.
Yes.
God damn it, dude.
This is why I'm a binge watcher and not a weekly watcher for anything.
it do be that way, though. But I will say, we do open up these episodes going into we return back to the Sun Pirates and Koala. And as we said in the summary, so Koala was the little girl that we saw in the last set of episodes. We knew Fisher Tiger was going to meet his ultimate demise. We weren't exactly sure necessarily how, but we knew that it was probably going to have something to do with Koala. So we return this little girl to the island, and they actually go through the whole bit where Koala gets home and she's like, yo, thanks, bro. Like, you guys are the best. And, you know, the inhabitants are like, I don't know, girl, you probably shouldn't call them the best. In the back of my mind, I know now that the reason why they said that is because they already fucking sold out, right? They knew that they were going to get ambushed out there in the field, and they didn't want to have like any emotional attachment to these people that brought this child back to their island, which I think is a fucking tragedy, by the way. What the hell, man?
Yeah, so I also just want to, I guess, I don't know, maybe I'm going to be the one correcting you for once, but the inhabitants of that actual island aren't the ones who called this in. It was a neighboring island. And then obviously the Navy showed up ahead of time and was like, hey, we're going to gank the people who are about to return this kid. That's why they know and are like feeling uncomfortable about everything, because the Navy's already there. And they're like, well, we can't tell them to like go home. We kind of appreciate this fisherman for bringing our daughter back. Like, the Navy's just going to be like, huh, that's great. And like pat them on the head and send them off with a candy and be like, yeah, we're going to kill this guy now. All right. But it was,
I must have like looked away or whatever then at that point.
Yeah. They say that a neighboring island, while they were there, I don't know, resupplying or whatever.
They caught wind of their plan. They were like, hey, yo, psst,
psst. Yeah.
Yo, he's coming through. He's like three blocks down. Get him.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Hey, I love that band. You can't say three anything down without saying I love that band. It's impossible. Three blank down. Love that band. Anyway, but three, that's actually down. Interesting. I think I sort of remembered, and maybe I'm just like I blanked out or whatever. I thought that they had said that the original old geezers that gave them Koala gave the intel to the Navy that they were on their way,
God,
to drop her
imagine
off.
Imagine that!
What a crazy twist that would be!
It's like, hey, thanks for freeing us from Mary Joie, but also we're selling you out to the government.
But also, we still.
In my mind, I'm like, well, what if they did that so that they could gain amnesty for the fact that they were once slaves. Do you know what I'm saying?
That's so fair. That's too fucked up of a world for me, at least for Odie, in my mind.
Is that too fucked up a world? That's the line that we're going to draw in the sand? I don't know, man.
Those
particular group of people, what I was thinking was, you know, the koala's neighbors, if you will, of her actual island homeland. What I was thinking was, you know, the reason they probably didn't intervene or speak up or say anything is just because, like, you know, the fucked up reality is like, hey, listen, we're really grateful for you returning koala. But like, the reality is that, like, celestial dragons are still powerful. We're still under threat from the Navy. Like, they could just switch up on us last second. It's nothing personal, but like, we got to save our own skin. And unfortunately, that costs you yours. You know what I mean?
I mean, that could still
really
be
fucked about that situation.
Yeah, I mean, that could still be the undertone here. But there's like not a lot of very explicit conversation from the inhabitants of the island to the fishman. So like their stake in the game beyond what they told Koala, like, hey, you probably shouldn't think of them as like allies or friends or whatever the hell. Beyond that context, we don't really know like where they stood in the in the situation. I guess you just kind of presume that maybe they didn't care, but or maybe they were under the gun. Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell.
I think both can be true. It's like, listen, even if we did like you, we don't like you enough to stick out our necks for the government. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which is that's just the fucked up world that Oda set up for us.
I like how you're going to say the fucked up world we lived in. Both are true. We're clear.
We do also live in that world. We just don't see it.
Can I tell you, man, before we even go any further, these are the kinds of episodes where I think long and hard about what this show speaks in social commentary about the real world. And it makes me question a lot of things. But, after Koala is returned, of course, well, not of course, but unfortunately, Fisher Tiger gets ambushed by the Navy. And after the skirmish, which, I mean, it was a fine skirmish. I would say that some of the animation here was a little gimmicky. But the rest of the fishmen, they were fighting some Navy goons, and Fisher Tiger suffers from life-threatening bullet wounds. When they finally win and they go back to the ship, we learn of the demon that resides within our boy Fisher Tiger here. So we kind of, I mean, did you have any doubts, Christian, that this dude might have been a slave in his past before he decided to go to the Red Line or whatever and free everybody? Like, did that come as a shock to you at any capacity?
I would say I was maybe a little surprised. It makes sense just thinking about it because, like, otherwise, like, sure, fishmen are slaves and he would have seen that. But when you think about the idea that he was a slave himself, it would make more sense as to why he was so willing to attack Mary Joie directly and risk life and limb to free the slaves like that. So I guess at the end of the day, though, I was still a little surprised that it turned out he was a He was a slave himself, but the sprinkles are there as the show gives back to you with a few flashbacks while he's laying there.
I'm not sure what Justin's perspective is, but it's not that it came as a surprise, but I kind of go back and forth on how I feel knowing the fact that Oda chose to write him as a former slave. I almost thought that it almost made him a more powerful leader, having only been exposed to slavery and the mistreatment of his people that drove him to become this, you know, I guess, hero amongst the rest of his men or whatever. Now, I think there's a conversation to be had for, but then that's how he's already viewed as by the rest of the fishmen. So by adding this layer of darkness to his character, you can almost make him a bit more, a bit weaker, that something to overcome. I don't know. But I actually kind of go back and forth on whether or not I like the fact that they threw this in his backstory. I'm curious what Justin thinks when he first watched these.
I see your point. I don't know if I feel strongly one way or the other. However, I think it adds a good detail to his character. Like, could he have just been the equally as good character without him requiring to be a slave? I don't know. I generally don't. And, we'll probably never know because that's just not what the story tells us, but I do enjoy that fact. I don't know, Fisher Tiger is just a great character, and knowing that, like, he's just overcome so much, especially when you like think about like what this man has had to emotionally endure for who knows how many years. And he's still like trying his. I think what the most shocking part about all this to me is Fisher Tiger has been seen as the, you know, the practical of his kind, right? He's like, okay, listen, I do truly wish to have some type of peaceful relationship between us and humans, right? But, you know, I'm also a pirate, or I have to, you know, get rough with people, blah, blah, blah. But I still try not to never, ever kill. And then I think it really hits me when he's walking Koala to her village and she wants to hold hands with him. And he just kind of tries to like wave her off. And I found that a little jarring, because I didn't think that wasn't the vision of Fisher Tiger in my head up until that point. And then as you progress through the episode, you're like, oh no, he's still like walking with a lot of baggage that he just can't resolve. And he still just has like that much more resentment just stored in him that he just can't get rid of. And I was like, ah, I see. Yes. You're not so, like this pseudo perfect character that you're mildly introduced as. Like, for me, I think like Fisher Tiger and Otohime's ideals are always juxtaposed to each other. And Fisher Tiger admits that Otohime's peaceful process, if you will, is better. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I think there is validity in Fisher Tiger's, you know, political form of rebellion and fighting the system. And many people may not agree with that, especially in our real world. That's fine. But I don't know if I would ever say like definitively the way he does is like, yeah, no, Otohime's way is correct. Mine is wrong, if not just inherently deeply flawed.
But I think
Fisher Tiger's character just became more dimensional in this episode particularly, because I think I somewhat put him on a pedestal and idolized him a bit too much, where I was like, ah, no, he's just, you know, it's like I gave Otohime crap for being an idealist. But then I personally idealized Fisher Tiger, where I was like, oh, no, he's like the goat. He's the guy. He's got the right way. You know what I mean? And then, you know, he unpacks his trauma on us. I'm like, ah, this guy doesn't have it figured out the way I think I thought he did. You know what I mean?
I think that that's actually what makes the two of these characters really gravitating and very interesting when they're put next to each other. We're exposed to Otohime here. Like, she's this idealistic leader. And Fisher Tiger comes off as a little bit more realistic. And yet in these episodes, especially at the time of his untimely demise, we realize that not only is he not that realistic, he's even irrational. He carries this absolutely irrational hatred to the species of humankind that he can't get rid of. He tries to be better. He tries to rise above it, yet his pride just can't be overcome. And of course, that leads us into what ultimately happens.
I want to cut in just slightly on your word choice, because I wouldn't necessarily classify his rage and hatred as irrational. I think he has a very rational reason for it. He was a slave and mistreated all of that time. He has a very, very good reason to dislike humans and what they stand for. I think,
sure,
instead of calling it irrational, I would say he has this contradiction inside of him where he knows that, or he feels in his heart of hearts, that Otohime's way is the right way, but he just can't bring himself to follow it fully because of what happened to him. So he has this whole catch-22 situation going on within him, and it's what's led him to the point he's at now, and ultimately what leads him to his decision in regards to saving his own life, essentially. So I just want to put that, the 2 cents there.
No, I appreciate it. And but we are brought to, so we were exposed to the plot element that at one point we were led to believe that the reason why Fisher Tiger was no more was because the humans denied him a blood transfusion, which was the tale that everyone realized, or that everyone at Fishman Island still believed to this day. That's kind of just like the hush hush. This is the situation. But the truth is, because Fisher Tiger couldn't overcome his own grief, he couldn't overcome his discrimination and his hatred, he refused the blood of any human because he had a very rare blood type that no other fishman had. And he decided that it would be better to die there on the table than it would be to accept and he says this specifically, than to accept the favor, or was it the I forget the word.
In the sub, he doesn't want to be indebted to humans.
Yeah, he said a couple of things, but part of it was like, I do not want to owe these. It was one part like, I do not want to be indebted to these people.
I don't want to be indebted to them. I don't want to have to owe their kind a damn thing.
And I definitely don't want their pity, which I thought was an interesting perspective from him. I was like, okay, being indebted, clearly that makes sense, right? Given the situation. Seeing this as pity, considering it's Aladdin, that's the doctor's name. Aladdin was just on the ship and he's like, hey, listen, these humans got a bunch of blood that you could easily use. Let's pump you in. He's like, nah, I don't want it. I'm like, I personally don't see the perspective of like humans showing pity on him in this context.
I think it's pity, but in another part, charity. He just can't see it as anything other than humankind stepping in and essentially giving him a second chance. And he just can't come to terms with that. I think in his mind, he sees this as the line in the sand. If I owe them anything for any reason, I will no longer be the person I am right now. And it terrifies him, the idea that he would actually owe them anything.
Oh, fair enough.
I lost my train of thought.
Fisher Tiger dies. And
Fisher Tiger dies. There we go. I found the thread.
Very conflicting ideals pop up between Jinbei and Arlong as well.
Yeah. So after Fisher Tiger dies, and now on his deathbed, he does. And this is some of the theme that I love the most. You know, I mentioned before that one of my favorite quotes, and it's not a new line of thinking by any means. One Piece didn't like invent it. But something that Doflamingo said back at the Marineford War is that the winners basically get to write history in any war. This is almost an addendum to that, where the common thread of these two characters and their story is what they want ultimately is to create a better world for the next generation, right? Fisher Tiger doesn't want the world to know that he refused human blood. In fact, he even explicitly says to the rest of the fishermen on his crew, our hate needs to die with us. Otherwise, nothing's ever going to change. And Otohime knows that as well, which is why she wants to push the next generation onto the surface. And when Fisher Tiger passes, that's when Jinbei sort of understands, okay, I get it. Yes, even though we all hate everything about the situation, we need to be a better version of ourselves for the next generation. And Arlong's having none of that shit. He's like, fuck this. He goes back to the island, gets beasted by Kizaru, gets immediately thrown into jail. And then Jinbei picks up the pieces and decides to become the new Sun Pirate Captain for a short-lived time until he becomes the warlord that we all know and love today. And in doing so this was Jinbei's ultimate plan. So he got invited to become a warlord while they were still, you know, palling around the seas doing their fishman thing. Ultimately, his only reason for joining was so that everyone on the crew that was a former slave could go back home and not be chased for evasion as a former slave any further. That was really what it came down to. He's like, hey, if I become a warlord, then everyone that was on my crew, they get a get out of jail free card, and that's okay for me. I'm good with that.
He also did add the addendum of like, and hopefully this will help the queen's goal in the end.
Yeah, which does of course move on. So that covers tragedy number one. The terrible irony that is at the healing juice being right next to the dying man, but he can't bring himself to take it. That's tragedy number one.
Before we move on to tragedy number two, I do want to cut in and speak of tragedy 1.1 personally. I think an additional tragedy to this Fisher Tiger storyline is the way the crew broke up after Arlong was freed from Impel Down. It sucks seeing how, you know, that clear divide that exists between like Arlong camp and Jinbei camp, right? I am most disgusted with the macro pirates because
honestly, same.
Like, I can understand Arlong's ruthlessness and anger, right? Like that makes sense to me. I can understand how you end up in that position. The macro pirates make no sense. Like, how do you go from being on Fisher Tiger's crew to literally selling your own people. Like, that is hatui.
I guess, like, you're supposed to just sort of, like, maybe with the power vacuum at work, because not everyone wanted Jinbei to lead, hence why half of them left with Arlong in the first place. And clearly the Marco gang didn't like Jinbei's leadership, which is why they fucking left. So I suppose in this event, we're supposed to recognize that Fischer Tiger was this paradigm that just could not be filled, certainly not by Jinbei alone. And it created this schism. But I agree. I don't understand for a second what would have possibly dawned on the macro pirates to become essentially traitors of mermaids and whatnot. Like, come on, man. Well, what the hell?
If I could just play a little bit of the advocate here, or try and explain macro group, I would. Mermaids and fish people sell for lots of money, and that money can buy them a stability they had never known in their lives.
Man,
so when they see an opportunity, and let's not fucking avert our eyes here. This is no different from human trafficking in real life. This is the same thing. So to say that they would turn on their own people is like, you could think that, but these things happen. This is, again, the parallels to our real world. So if I were to attempt to explain macro's side of things, it would be the idea of financial stability, especially.
Yeah, they're seeking out a type of peace and, like you said, stability that they've never really known growing up in the slums of the Fishman district back home or whatever.
Yes.
Which I can understand
if they were even slaves. I don't know if they were slaves or not, but if they were slaves, yeah, then they know the pain of that. So, yeah, maybe they weren't. You would hope that someone who was a slave would be much less willing to sell other people into slavery, but shit happens. They could still have been slaves and been like, fuck it, like, I don't care. I saw this side and I realized it makes shit tons of money, so I'm gonna do it too, you know?
Shit. This is tragedy 1.1, isn't it? this is the scar, the scab that festers at society that we can't ever hope to truly heal. Oh no. But that does move us into the beginnings of tragedy number two. And this does take us into Queen Otohime and her ongoing battle to convince the entirety of Fishman Island to join the surface world. What I find most heartbreaking, well, not most heartbreaking, but one of the heartbreaking things I do love about this is that we start off Fisher Tiger's known to be dead, and all of the fishmen that had signed the papers, we immediately cut to a scene with Otohime being like, hey, yeah, I've got like, you know, 1,000 signatures right now and I need to get 5 million one day, but we'll get there one step at a time. And all of these fishman goons from out of the woodwork go like, yeah, can we just undo? Take those back. Yeah.
Control Z, like, Control Z.
Control Z. I was like, oh no, don't drive the knife directly into this poor woman's heart. Come on, dude.
The absolute loss of something. I don't know what exactly, but the life draining from her eyes as she just watches all these citizens just withdraw their signatures just absolutely breaks her and crushes her. In a way that I don't think many of us thought was possible.
I think the most devastating too is the children that walk up to her, because she so dearly holds these children close to her heart. And she goes out of her way to teach them, and when they run up, seemingly excited, she's like, "Oh, you guys want another lesson on the human world or the surface world?" And they're like, "No, we're here to take these papers back." And
I I think what hurts most there is that what a little children, at least from my perspective, it doesn't sound like this was their own thought. It was, my mom said to take my signature back. Like,
right.
This is just, you know, the old guard influencing the new generation after both Fisher Tiger and Otohime have established, like, listen, the only way we get past this is a clean slate. And right now you're soiling the other slate that's forming. You know what I mean?
It's another knife twist, as we now realize that her ultimate goal is to teach the next generation not to carry the same level of discrimination and fear that their parents have. And at the end of the day, their parents are there essentially teaching them, nope, being afraid is good. This is our safe place. We must ignore all of the cries for anything different. And then we also get that bit with Otohime, who it was sad. Don't get me wrong, but it was kind of funny when she was drunk off her ass, just yelling at her people.
And holy shit, can she hold her liquor, guys?
Golly, oh did you gosh. See yeah, like how many
a dozen bottles surrounding yeah. her?
Now I know why King Neptune felt so King infatuated Neptune with her. Baby,
a real keeper, that's for sure.
Yeah, or something. I don't know what happened there, dude. Jesus Christ. She was very she had a lot of diction and was able to speak her piece very well for somebody that had drank in 12 full bottles of alcohol. Holy mother of God. But moving on from the time that she was drunk, we do cut to a scene where a celestial dragon, of all fucking people. If this backstory wasn't already, you know, full enough of, you know, nonsense, tragedy and, you know, assholes, we got a celestial dragon out of all fucking things coming out of nowhere. And we find out that, of course, he's there in true celestial dragon dickheadery to retrieve his property as he sees it. The fishman that took refuge back up on Fishman Island after Jinbei became a warlord, the previous slaves were like, yeah, we know you used to be our slave keeper. We're not going with you. And the celestial dragon Miosgard was he was a little surprised, to say the least. Fucking dickhead, dude.
That's what
bro,
I'm saying,
bro. This man right here is the living embodiment of what our modern age Caucasity is.
Dude, he's so privileged.
My man.
Fuck this guy.
Rolled up into enemy territory, dick in his hand. And he was like, you're coming with me because I said so. Because the world up above agrees that I am like the law, right? I am the will and the way. And everyone's just like, you don't get it. And the fact that you just don't get it is what pisses us off even more. That like, we don't owe you anything. We're in entirely different rules down here. We could feed you to freaking shrimp and piranhas, and we could just write it off as a happy little accident. Mm-hmm, and he still has the gall to be just pull out his gun. He's like, pew pew pew. Someone give me a doctor. Where's my doctor? Where's anyone of any semblance of intelligence in here to help me out? And oh my God, I wish Otohime did not intervene. That dude deserved to get capped. All right.
I don't think you're learning the lessons that this story is supposed to teach you, Justin.
No. I'm learning. They're teaching the wrong lesson. That's the lesson most of all here. Fish
eat the rich.
Justin's villain arc.
Listen, Arlong's Justin's making a whole lot of sense these past couple of weeks, is all I'm saying.
Oh, no.
Not Arlong. At least not a tiger Arlong. Or something. Like, come on, man.
We're losing
a Fisher Tiger was sitting on the fence for too long. Arlong had to take action, and I'm here for it.
Instead of eat the rich, it's feed the rich to the sea kings in this case.
Listen, God, someone's got to eat them, man. Go be me. They're scum. Tweet. Feed them to the fishies.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to eat that either. And you know, the two lines that strike out to me the most in this too is that he's still like, even as they're about to shoot him and, you know, kill his ass, the last thing he says is, you're just a bunch of stupid fish, number one. And then the other line that sticks out to me, of course, is the, I thought everyone always just respected me. Like, no, nobody fucking respects you. You're an asshole.
No one likes you.
Nobody fucking respects you. It actually is very telling and interesting that, especially in this story, how they're 10,000 meters below, you know, the surface or whatever, how they're so far away from the highest heights of the Red Line. And at the end of the day, they realize that anything could happen and they would probably get off scot-free. They're talking about it, too. They're like, hey, wait, I mean, I'm not going to tell anybody. Are you going to tell anybody? And they're all like, no, I'm not going to fucking
Hell
tell anybody.
No.
Hell no, I'm not going to tell anybody.
Stitches
get this
stitches.
Guy.
Fuck that.
Cap his ass. Pin his muffin cap
his
back
ass.
Blue.
So, and this is the byproduct of the systemic discrimination within the fishmen. Public, where they're just like, nah, fuck this guy. I'm so sick and tired of having to deal with these assholes. And unfortunately, I'll say fortunately, Otohime does show up at the last second to reserve the life of this fucking insect Miosgard. Fuck this guy. But Otohime, amen. She, with the kindness in her heart, protected him from getting capped and, of course, took the bullet herself, in fact. Forced the rest of the fishman people to help Miosgard get on his merry fucking way and get back up to the surface.
I also just want to call attention quickly before we skate past it to the.
We forgot this part. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I don't know. I don't know if whatever you're about to say is what I'm
sure you're going to talk about Shira Hoshi and Vander Decket or whatever.
wasn't even a little bit on my mind. I was going to call attention to the one fisherman who was doing most of the talking to the Celestial Dragon, and the idea that he says at one point that he could have, if he was literally anybody else, forgiven him and maybe let him live and not shot him on the spot. But because it was the exact Celestial Dragon that had enslaved him, he was going to put the bullet in his head. And I just, I feel like this is this was part of the step in the right direction for Fishman as a whole, because it means that probably Otohime's lessons / ideals were getting to some of even the most hardened of hearts down in Fishman Island. You know, this guy was a whole slave, became a fishman, a sun pirate to go out and do all of that raving and rampaging through the surface world, but still almost couldn't bring himself to shoot the guy who had imprisoned him and forced him into slavery for years on end. So I like to take that as a good sign at that moment in time for
Fishman Island. I think Otohime is rubbing off on you. It sounds like you're a little idealistic in there, Christian.
I was in Otohime's camp during the last episode, and I feel like this episode has only strengthened that opinion for reasons we'll get to a little later.
Yeah, absolutely. But before we do continue onward from the primary plot, so there's a supplementary plot that gets kind of thrown in here. So we do get the backstory with Vander Decken as he figured or found Shira Hoshi. So I guess we're led to believe that he didn't really give a fuck about Shira Hoshi until he noted. So she does this thing where when the gun goes off, and I think her mom, wait, was it when Otohime got shot and she saw that she was wounded?
It was at this point with the Celestial Dragon where she got, she was grazed with it. Everyone was real going crazy. She thought was
dying.
And
then Mjolnir, because he's a shithead, after the kindness of her heart, he was like, aha, I have your stupid goldfish queen now. And now you're all going to do everything I say. And that was when Shira Hoshi freaked the fuck out.
And all the kids are there. I forget exactly what brought them down. Oh, because they just followed mom, because mom ran out of the palace and they were we got to see what's going on. So they followed her, and then they all see and what's happening. And she gets real, Shira Hoshi, that is, gets very upset and does a thing.
And does a thing indeed.
Yeah, she cries, and through the cry, so this is where we're kind of like exposed to this like new bit of like lore and background. So she's apparently this special mermaid. There, apparently one is born into the royal family, however many fucking years. I think it was like 1,000 years or some nonsense, that can talk to sea kings. So it's been known that fishmen can talk to fish, and specifically King Neptune can even talk to whales, which is even rarer. But that's kind of like where everything like ends. Like the fishermen can't talk with any other creature. They can't talk with the giant sea kings that roam the calm belt or that roam the Grand Line or whatever. It falls on deaf ears is what they explicitly say. All but one single mermaid that is apparently born every 1,000 years that can just casually do that. And the sea kings are like, ooh, I love that sound. And they do everything it says.
It's their siren song.
It's the siren call. And apparently that's Shira Hoshi, of course, which is what inspires Vander Decken. And I thought that she was like fucking like 6 years old in this flashback. And I'm pretty sure she is, which is real fucking you, dude. You got to stop.
Okay. It does. They say that later, that she is six. Yes.
What was worse for me was I was huffing some big copium at this particular scene where I was like, okay, clearly it's a younger Decken. I don't actually know how old he is. I was like, maybe they're closer in age than I realized. Maybe they're both kids.
Yeah, that's definitely.
And as he kept talking, He just kept opening his mouth. And I was like, wow, no, I'm so wrong. And I'm just huffing some copium.
There was a point, right? When we first see Deccan again, he's talking with his two goons or whatever. They go see what's up. And then we get the backstory about Vanderdecken the First came down here because he had heard about this legend and wanted to claim this mermaid or find this mermaid for himself so they could take over the world, whatever. So we have that backstory. So this becomes the only reason that Vanderdecken wants to marry Shirahoshi. But then he points it out himself, to be fair, at the start. He goes, wait a minute, she's like really young, though. I guess I'm going to have to wait. And then we cut it off there. We revisit them like 5 or 10 minutes later when his goons come up and they go like, yo, we found this sick ass box that whoever opens it, they get turned older. So now you can totally give it to Shirahoshi and then she'll be older and you can marry her. And he's like, fuck yes, this is the best. You guys are the best. Go steal it right now. And then,
well, no, hold on. He was kind of like that, but then the goons were, I think the goons asked, so are we going to steal the box? And then he's like, no, I'll marry her first. We'll deal with the box second. Let's make sure we got her first.
He goes, go steal the box. And then he second guesses himself and he goes like, wait, that's in the palace. That might be kind of hard. And the goons, like, they start sweating and then he goes, it's kind of hard. And they're like, oh, thank God. But then he goes, the goons suggest,
say like, well, if you marry her first, you can get to the palace easy.
Yeah. So if you get married to her first, then you can get into the palace and then you can give her the box. So it's not weird. And Vanderdecken like slaps his knee and is like, that's a fucking great idea. Why didn't I think of that? And then it becomes like officially very, very, very bad.
Especially when there's a scene where I think the goons ask, like, don't you think she would like grow up and to be like a great, beautiful woman? Or I'm very much tidying up their actual language because I don't want to make myself sick. But, you know, they got real creepy with it. And it's so bad. This is the worst plot of all of One Piece. I hate it here.
Vanderdecken the pedophile is not the villain I need in my pirate
Which
anime.
Which only confirms Shirahoshi as 16 in the present day even, so...
Yeah.
Still not great.
Feeling very not great on that one, Vanderdecken.
But, you should at least he only started with notes, didn't go straight to the axes right off the bat.
There was a period of time where, you know, he sent actual love letters instead of, you know, things to maim her with.
The love letters even feels like a strong term. The one we see literally just says marry me, or I presume, or you should marry me, I presume, and then it just has it's his name signed on it.
Fucking stupid dude. I hate this stupid ass goon. I can't wait for it. I hope he just gets got. I want him to get gatted, you know. We can replace Mjolskard, put fucking Vanderdecken in there and we can call it a day. That's all I'm saying.
Unfortunately, Vanderdecken lives in the present day and we all know that guns don't work in present day scenarios, so
God, I hate it here.
You know what? Okay, this is like kind of like messed up for me, but I'm genuinely curious. I feel like when this episode releases, we should drop a poll on our socials and just ask our fans, like, hey, who would you cap first, Mjolskard or Vanderdecken? Just out of curiosity.
That's a hard one, though. Oh, no. Because who knows what Mjolskard did? He's the devil you don't know. Like,
I'm going to go with a solid Mjolskard. Vanderdecken is he's got very bad ideas in this scenario, but ultimately he hasn't actively hurt anybody because of it.
I don't even know if I agree with that.
Shirahoshi's mental state, but like Mjolskard has absolutely murdered
my man's
people.
Laundry list is 10 times the length that Vanderdecken could ever achieve.
That's
right?
What I'm saying.
That's very true. That is very true.
Mjolskard dream of having a fucking list like Mjolskard does.
But returning to Mjolskard and everyone's favorite Otohime. She does decide, and I really like this gesture too. So she decides that she wants to go to the surface with Mjolskard. She calls him out. She's like, hey, you clearly got some dirty laundry that you still want to air out. You're unhappy. I'm unhappy. Let me go with you. Let's talk this out. You know, fucking kingdom to kingdom. I don't know why he agrees, but he does. He's just kind of like reluctantly, all right, get the fuck on the boat, fucking goldfish or whatever
in the matter. This is still an entire boat full of fishermen. Oh, okay. And
that's very true. And
he's being taken out of the goodwill of the humans, or not the humans, the fishmen. So he doesn't really have a say in the matter.
I guess I didn't see it like that in my mind. And you're right, because it is a fishman's boat. It's actually that same. I don't even know what you call it. Is it a coelacanth? It's like some kind of special eel or whatever the fuck. I forget what they're called. I saw it in Animal Crossing one time. That's the only reason I know it exists.
All maritime knowledge comes from Animal Crossing.
I thought
Crossing.
He was going to fit my brain completely with Animal Planet. You know, he said Animal Crossing. What the hell?
It's an oar fish. That's what it was. It was an oar fish. Yeah. It's the same oar fish boat that the princes were driving around
before.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That exact same boat. Or at least it looks like the same boat. But that oar fish boat or whatever was the one that moved Mioskar to the surface. So I guess it would make sense by extension that it was captained by predominantly fishmen. I guess I didn't actually catch that in reality. But yeah, so if she invited herself, then she wanted to go to the surface. She wanted to talk with Mioskard or whatever. And her ultimate plan, and this is what she tells her people, because at one point Neptune's like, bro, I mean, wife, please, let me go.
She can be bro. You don't know.
Yeah, I guess it could be bro.
She gives off a lot of bro energy because, goddamn, does this plan take balls of steel, brother?
Does
holy shit.
Holy hell, dude. I was scared. Okay, so can I be honest? So we know she dies. Right. We know that that's a part of her backstory. OK, hold on. Shut the fuck up. Anyway, going into the backstory, this is actually one of Oda's stupid fucking gotcha moments, because even though we know she dies, this was the moment when I was a first watcher. Maybe this happened to you, Christian. If it didn't, whatever, power to you. I thought this was when she dies. I thought she was never going to come back. That the last memory they have of her. In fact, I honestly thought that there was a non-zero chance as I was watching this as a first timer that the grave was a misdirect and they just made it or erected it because she never came back or something. So maybe she just got enslaved and maybe that would serve as a plot point later down the line. And I was immediately like unhinged or whatever, or taken away from that when after she departed, she inevitably does return, and with the favor of the celestial dragons. I don't know how the fuck she managed it, but somehow she convinced that gaggle of terrible human beings to say, hey, we deserve a right to be at the world summit. And they agreed. I still can't wrap my head around it. She's a great politician.
I took it a step further.
Go ahead.
When in the disbelief of like, oh man, this is it. Like, she's been gone for a long time. It's over. Like, she ain't coming back. What my brain went to the worst possible scenario. And I was like, you know, what could possibly happen as the most like messed up thing about this is that she dies up there. And then Mioskard comes back down. He's like, hey, to like say thank you for like, I guess, saving my life or whatever, you treasonous rats. Here's her queen's corpse. And then like, they bury her on Fishman Island. I'm like, oh my God.
Wow. That's visual and a half, and I hate it.
That would be devastating.
I did not trust that piece of paper from the World Noble one bit.
Oh, so you think even now it's all bullshit?
I think it was only to serve the purpose of giving them whatever hope they wanted. Maybe she just annoyed the shit out of them for 5 days. And
that's what I'm thinking.
And then finally they were like, yeah, fuck it. All right, sure. We endorse this emigration thing or whatever you were talking about. And then they go back to fucking drugs and alcohol like they usually do. And then the assassin who we meet later is a human. I'm convinced that was a plot. That has to be like a World Noble plot to just get her back down there, give the fishmen hope, and then immediately eradicate it with a human assassin.
Man. Okay. Tinfoil hat on for me. I think that guy that Hody and whoever stumbled upon, he's a, whatchamacallit?
Slave?
No. He's the fall guy. He's the fall guy. Like, he didn't commit the actual assassination. The problem with my little tinfoil hat is I'm not sure who's framing him. My brain is like, yo, what if Hody did it himself and then just had a human take the fall for it? But I'm like, I don't think Hody's that radicalized yet. But like, my brain is like, nah, this is too easy. This is too on the nose. Like, this is probably a fisherman's doing, and they're just framing a human because they just, you know, they're trying to get their point across or whatever. That's my little conspiracy theory brain going off right now.
It's fair. I could definitely see that happening too. But I think the paper endorsed by a world noble, whether your part is true or not, I think the paper is bullshit. I think they would have gotten up there even if this hadn't happened, and they would have been like, "So you have a piece of paper with some writing on it. Who cares? Go back where you came from, uglies."
Like, go back where you came from, uglies.
I think it would have ultimately meant nothing to the world nobles if they had tried to come back here with it.
Could you imagine if this paper means nothing? That means Otohime died for nothing, essentially. She inspired her people with a lie.
Yeah.
It feels like the same line as Fisher Tiger right now. He's trying to inspire people by maybe not lying so much as just omitting the truth.
Oh my God. No, I don't want to believe this timeline.
Just broke the glass for Brendan.
I don't want to believe this. Give me a smidge of hope, please.
Just give me my ignorance back. I don't want this knowledge.
Give me my ignorance back. I'm begging you. I want to believe that she convinced just one asshole. Come on, there's got to be a fleet of them up there.
A little too much CNN, and now you're indoctrinated.
No!
Wait, CNN?
Yeah, that's the left version of Fox News is what they say. Although I would call it rather centrist.
CNN?
Yeah, he's making a joke here, Brendan.
Oh, I see. I see.
Sea anemone.
It's all connected.
Can I tell you too? The names of the areas in Fishman Island are hilarious. There's one area called Conchcord, and I find that incredible.
The only one I remember is Fishfrilly Hills.
Fishfrilly Hills is also the banger
rich man. That was the rich man's area where Papa Goo lived, I think.
Living it up West Hollywood.
I just really like Conchcord Avenue. That's fire. But yeah, so she does come back, and we've touched on it. After she returns, all the fishmen, and I do like that the first ones to agree again to return to the surface, of course, to really drive in the nail that what's most important is the impression of the next generation. The kids were the first ones to drop their names back in the box. And after she, and then she was, Otohime was a little worried. She was like, "Listen, if you're going to take them back, like, don't. And they were like, "No, like, our parents said we can, and they're going to do it too." And then everyone puts in their goddamn signatures into the basket.
I know.
And it's one of the most wholesome.
And then the geezer comes up when the basket's getting super full, and he's like, "Miss Otohime, that basket's looking a little too small for all these signatures." And then your main man, I think he was
Minister
the right hand.
Right.
I think
he was the, yeah, he's Mr. The
I
right.
think he was the right. Comes up, yeah, and yeah. He was been waiting for this moment. He's got, "Guys, I've got the big one," and he slams down this giant basket that he probably had commissioned just for this moment, just in case. And
just in case,
everyone's vibing with it.
Yeah, dude, it's a real good feel good moment, especially with how jam packed these episodes have been with giving you the carrot and then immediately ripping it out of your miserable, grubby little fingers. This was the nicest and most wholesome moment that we got in the entire episode, was when the entire island came together and they were like, "Yes, we do believe in what our queen accomplished here today. If she can do it, then so can we." Which ultimately does lead us traumatically and dramatically into her assassination, which, as we've touched on, so it was a human found that was exposed as the saboteur, and originally even Jinbei was like, we can't let the people know it was a human. If they know, then shit's gonna hit the fucking fan out here. We can't do this. But then Hody's like, "Bro, fuck that shit. They need to know." And I kind of agree, but I also don't. I'm a little upset about it, if I'm going to be honest. Like, maybe we could have talked about it. We could have hashed it out. But he demonstrates to the entire population of Fishman Island that some human was the one that assassinated Otohime. We don't know the details. We don't know if it was a plot maybe by the Celestial Dragons, or if this random ass human was just like, huh, I don't like the words coming out of this goldfish's mouth, I'm gonna shoot her, which I kind of find a little hard to believe. I'm sure that when we get more details, we'll get a little bit more of the situation out of the deal. But that was tragedy number two, was despite Otohime's best efforts, It was none other than a human that ultimately assassinated her as she finally won over the will of the people to move the island to the surface.
Gosh, it's so gut-wrenching, man. These are the moments that I assume people talk about a lot when they refer to One Piece having such an amazing plot.
Because these moments, I would say,
really, they take their time in getting here, but everything is very meaningful and purposeful as the story is told, and then it leads to moments like these that you're just like, oh my. And then shortly after, between her and her children, when Shirahoshi's going off for the second time, because we got that whole little foreshadowing bit like 5 minutes earlier, that of Otohime with the three princes, and she's like, look, I got to level with you kids. If Shirahoshi does it again, and it's anything worse than just seeing me get held hostage, it could mean the end of us all. Fishman Island could just be gone, swallowed up by Sea Kings. So then you have that fucking moment of like the three princes are around her, she's dying, she like waves off the doctor who's about to come and save her, and then they all notice Shirahoshi, who is just beginning to start wailing, and the ground is shaking, and everyone, the people who know, are like, oh my god, it's happening again. And the princes, specifically the two other ones,
they all recognize.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, what were their names?
I remember Momboshi. He's the plumper one. Fukuboshi is the blue haired guy. I'm gonna level with you. I always forget the yellow one.
Okay, that's fine. They all recognize what's happening with Shirahoshi, but I really love the two that just. They swallow back their tears as much as they can, and they do. I mean, in my head, I was thinking of something a little more lighthearted, like, you know, if anyone with younger siblings knows, if you've been wrestling a little too hard, or you take something from the little one, or you accidentally bonk them on the head and they start crying, and then suddenly you're in panic mode because you don't want your parents to hear them crying from the other room. So you're like, ha ha, oh, look at the funny faces I can make. Guy, yeah. Don't cry. Mom's going to fucking have my ass if you do. except in this case, it's a much more serious situation, but just watching them desperately try to get Shirahoshi's attention and cheer her up even a little bit, and it works, thankfully, and she's able to calm down enough to go and comfort their mother for the last time. It's just, oh my god, oh my god.
This is actually
I don't know what else to say about it, man. It hurts so much.
This is another thing that I love about Oda's writing, and I don't make it a secret that I like a lot of his writing, but we are exposed to Momboshi, and I feel so bad that I don't know his name. In fact, can one of you just find it out for me so that I don't feel like an asshole? Guy,
I know what you're about to say too, and I love this idea too.
They introduce these two the three princes are introduced to us. We know Momboshi is this dancing guy that goes like Mamba Mamba when we're first exposed to him. And then the other one, the singing one, goes do re mi fa with like every and like at the end of every one of his sentences.
Ryuboshi.
Thank you. So Ryuboshi and Momboshi. It's exposed to us as like a gimmick, right? Like it's a part of like this.
Like another verbal tick that we've seen plenty of.
But what does this motherfucker do? He finds a way to incorporate it within their character through trauma of all things, and make it a core part of who they are, so for somebody else's benefit. Oh my god, I hate what he does this to me.
It's such a good detail if you remember it too, because I did remember it when he started going Mamba Mamba, and the other one does the Fo Re Mi La, whatever. I was like, wait. You can't just do this.
You can't just do this with my heart. You can't
just do this. This is some Hodor level shit right here.
This is some Hodor shit right here, dude. It really is. Oh, my fucking God. I can't. This dude's an animal, and I'm here for it. I slurp that shit up. I love it every time. I say I hate it, but the reality is I love every fucking bit of it. Ryuboshi and Momboshi, we learned the origin of their social tics, and it's this heartwarming scene where they're trying to keep, as you said, Shirahoshi from losing a gasket as their mother lay there dying. And after she ultimately passes, I also like that we didn't just completely disregard the sheer trauma and I guess sadness that Neptune must have felt due to what happened to his wife. We even got cut to an entire scene devoted exclusively to him, and he goes into the tower that Shirahoshi eventually gets put to so that Vanderdecken can't be an asshole or whatever. He locks himself in the tower and says, "Do not let me out until my bloodlust subsides." And you just hear this man punching the wall, bashing his head against the damn door, and he even gets this whole, it's like monologue where he can't come to terms with the fact that he doesn't think he can be the sort of leader that Otohime was because of his troubled past. He sees himself as this murderer. She was pure. She was this this perfect human being, this perfect fish person that could basically take their people into the next generation. And he doesn't feel like he can fill that role because of the things that he's had to deal with his past. He was a soldier. He's killed. He's done all of these terrible things. He's no better than half the humans on the surface. So he doesn't know who's going to be able to carry the mantle of his late wife. Luckily, that's not a problem he has to solve immediately. But God, I love that we got a minute just to like expose ourselves to poor Neptune's plight and all this.
Because he's mostly taken his role in the backstory is not in focus because he doesn't really play a part in Otohime's plight here. And we learned that was by his own design. And I just, he has that line too that just also rips your gut out in any media it's presented to you in, where he says, "Why do the innocent die while I still keep on living?"
God, man.
Just a super heavy, like, survivor's guilt weighing on his conscious over everything between his time as a soldier and then obviously just now with Otohime is so awful.
Yeah, but after he finally does come down, he finally resolves, he comes out of his grief, and he decides to go to Otohime's funeral. The kids don't get to go, unfortunately, because this is when Vanderdecken, in his shitty ass ways, begins to do his shit. And Neptune's like, "I got enough happening. I don't want any of my kids to like risk any fall." So,
okay, wait. I also want to run us back to the first time Shirahoshi goes crazy, was it at this point? I think it's right before this point. I think it's when Otohime gets held up by the celestial dragon guy. This is the opportunity that the grease ball fucking takes to go touch Shirahoshi while all this shit is going down.
Okay, yeah, it's the second
animal,
time,
dude.
Mom just got gunned down, and he's like, "Hey,
God, her mom."
And he's like, "Hey,
down,
this must
like...
be really hard for you." Pat on shoulder or whatever.
God,
and I'm like,
I hate
bro,
it.
You just you're Oda. Like, I understand villains are not meant to be liked. You didn't have to do this good of a job. You could have held back a little bit. Right?
You didn't have to do it this hard, okay?
You could have made him slightly likable. Come on.
Not
just
even
like a little bit of good character in him.
No.
Just like the tiniest.
He gets nothing. He's a brainless idiot.
God damn. He's the Waluigi of One Piece, I'm telling you.
No.
Don't disrespect Waluigi like this.
I think he might be the Waluigi of this fucking series right now, dude. I'm putting my foot down
There's
on that. I hate
aesthetic,
it.
Aesthetic, but that's not the point here, all right?
I don't know, man. Like, he's definitely, if Foxy is Wario, this motherfucker's Waluigi for sure.
Oh, God.
These two together would not make for a very good pair. I'm just saying.
Who's the Mario and Luigi then?
The Mario and Luigi. we can have it be Sanji and Zoro. How about that?
I'll accept these answers like for one. Now. I think it needs. I think this question requires more thinking.
Requires more gusto, huh?
It does require.
What
more
about
gusto,
what about Cha-Pa-Pa being Mario then? I'm just trying, man. I'm reaching. Well, I'm now thinking
you're trying.
Ideas.
Now you're not trying enough. So you want no, to I'm not. Cha-Pa-Pa up there.
Cha-Pa-Pa. Cha-Pa-Pa. All right. Anyway, excuse me. Sorry, I got lost in the sauce. But yeah, so Neptune does decide that this is not an appropriate time for his kids to attend their mother's funeral because they're apparently being hunted by Vanderdecken or something. And he's like big scared. He's like, I don't want any of my family to have to suffer right now. This is not the time. So they don't get to go to their own mother's funeral, which is just a crying shame. And beyond a shadow of a doubt, the entirety of the island is there because they all love the shit out of her. And at this point, this is when Fukuboshi comes online. And he, with a transponder snail, he decides to tell the people of the island he understands that it's a difficult time and that they can't set aside their grief. And even further, he's going to destroy or remove all of the signatures that have been collected thus far to give the island time to cope and heal from the tragedy that they just that just happened. And they even say, you know, it doesn't matter. We don't have to attend the reverie in the next 2 years. There'll be one in 6. And if we don't go to that one, there'll be one in 10. And we will keep the flame alive for however long it takes to finally return to this point where we're willing to put trust in the humans. And my God, they lost their mom and they were able to be like, OK, we can do this. We'll basically carry the burden of our late mother and start from square one because that's what she would have wanted. And I'm like, fuck, dude, good on you. That's a lot to decide.
It takes a lot of moral character to make that sort of decision in just a couple of days, you know?
Yeah, it was a lot, dude. And then we do get to the end of the story. Now, okay, I actually watched a little bit further, so I won't chime in any further over what happens next, but this is the end of Jinbei's story. And next week we'll continue on and start to figure out like how does the rest of the straws digest this information, which one of them cares. So we did it though. We got through the entire backstory. Hey,
oh my gosh,
fucking woof, am I right?
Yeah. Fucking say that shit again.
I don't really know.
And before none of the Straw Hats are even paying attention,
dude. Facts.
Oh god, please.
No, I don't know how to articulate myself like at face value all the time, but I will say this backstory, this is one of the ones that I think back to a lot. And this is one, it's easy to reflect the themes in real world. And it's also so much fun to peel back the layers of the characters that Oda had been writing back in Nami's arc, back when we first got to Saba Odie, and all of these tiny set pieces come together to this pinnacle relationship battle between humans and fishmen that we don't see with really any other race in the franchise. And it's just the antithesis between being on the surface, being 10,000 feet below the surface. Otohime's like, why do your kids always fucking swim all the way up to the top? Well, it's because they dream of going up there, man, and y'all are suffocating them. And it hurts, man. I think about this a lot.
No, it's understandable. This is heavy stuff. And it makes for very interesting storytelling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is another one of the points in the story where I give a lot of credit for the way that Oda writes these very kiddie narratives. But when you break them down, you're like, this is heavy shit. This is very dark stuff you're covering, my guy.
Yeah, I was like, wait a minute. This is more than I bargained for here, Oda. I was here for memes and pirates doing dumb shit. Now yeah. I'm crying in my bed at 2 a.m. with a pint of ice cream. Like, what the fuck are you doing to me, man?
These are the highs I live for, dude. Like,
I will say I'm interested, especially next week, to see how... I feel like out of any of them that are listening right now, Nami seems like she has the most investment in what exactly went on back here. So I would be interested to see exactly how she ends, what her immediate thoughts are anyway, with Jinbei finishing his story here. And I'll also put in that I'm a little, I don't want to say annoyed, but like, I wish we had seen the specific point where Jinbei told Arlong to just fuck off to East Blue. I don't know if maybe that
got... Oh, did you guys not get that?
So
that Arlong, did happen in mine. Sorry, I can explain it to you if you want.
It's after they fight, right? When he breaks him out from, or not breaks him out, but he's released from Impel Down. They reconvene on whatever Shindig Island they're on, right?
Yeah. So they just have a fight, and then essentially Jinbei's like, "You can go do whatever you want. I won't be. I'm not going to hold you back." And then that's when Arlong just goes, "Fine, I'm going to fuck off and do my own thing." And then he takes Hachi and the rest of them with him.
Yeah, I guess. No, we did get that. I guess when Jinbei always said, and it was always said in the show that he unleashed him on the East Blue, I guess I assumed maybe Jinbei specifically told him to go to the East Blue, not that he just told Arlong to fuck off, or Arlong said he was gonna fuck off, and saying he unleashed him on East Blue was just him taking responsibility for the fact that he didn't stop Arlong in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that's the really big takeaway, is he takes full responsibility. I think that the word unleashed is used by him specifically because in his eyes, there's no difference between just letting him do whatever he wants and essentially releasing him to like do havoc on the rest of the world. Whereas the last time we kind of got this like expectation was when Yosuke said it. He's like, yeah, he released Arlong and sent him to the Grand or to the East Blue to like fuck shit up. Maybe that was his perspective, but that's not the real case. Even though Jinbei takes full responsibility in that way, it's not really what happened. However, in his eyes, I don't think he sees the difference. I think he's totally okay with admitting, I essentially sent Arlong to fuck everything up, and I'm very sorry.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then Hachi was like, I guess I'm here now.
God, poor fucking Hachi, man. I feel so bad for Hachi that he got sucked in, because he's such a fun loving, kind octopus fishman. And when he was playing with Koala at the very start of the episodes, and he's like big chilling with her, trying to talk her up and like to be like, hey, what a nice outfit you have on today or whatever. And then fucking Arlong's got to come over and push her face in the dirt like, oh, you're a filthy fucking human. Fuck you. And then we get past that. Yeah, she still got this floor cleaning habit inside of her when she gets
how she manages her anxiety.
Yeah. Like, when she gets really stressed, she's like, oh, I'm just going to go clean now. And we get past that. And he immediately picks up. And he's like, yo, Koala, check out this pearl I've got. Try and figure out which hand I've got it in. And she's having a blast in the background. I'm like, oh, Hachi, you're such a fucking, what a sweetheart, man. And then he gets dragged in with Arlong just because he was childhood friends. And the other karate shark was kind of basically forced him into it, too. Like, he was like, come on, Hachi, we're getting in the car. Get in the car, Hachi.
Mom and dad had a divorce. We're going with dad.
Yeah. I just I'm so upset for Hachi. Also, sick ass hairstyle back then too.
Dude, that's what I'm saying.
I love the pulled back ponytail, still in the star.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now my man's hairline is nowhere to be found. Those 10 years were not kind to Hachi.
Oh boy.
At least his hairline.
All right. Well, there is still, I mean, I would say there's a lot more to be said, but I feel like these episodes just by sheer nature of being invoke like a lot of commentary that could be talked about in mass for a very long period of time. But ultimately, I do feel like we got to basically the end of of these episodes here. I mean, unless you guys have any other dying things you want to throw or bring to the table before we cut out.
Nah, I think we've hit the important story beats here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes. Well, then with that being said, next week is going to be 547 to 551. And moving on to quotes.
I got a few.
Yeah.
I got a few. So towards the this one was basically when Tiger was sitting on the table and has already refused to take the blood, and he's lamenting to them and telling them that Otohime's way is the right way, and he explains this by saying There are plenty of kind-hearted humans in this world, and we all know that. And yet, those of us who die only leave hatred in this world. Isn't that absurd?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just such a good way to take the hammer to the nail. And I think it really did kind of resonate with just about all of them there, minus Arlong and a couple of his goons, and probably Macro also. So I enjoyed that quote. This one's for Justin, and I guess Devin by proxy a little bit. When Vanderdecken's goons are pointing out how grown she's going to get because she's already giant at 6 years old, they go like, well, I mean, you're gonna marry her, but like, she's gonna be huge, isn't that like kind of crazy? And Vanderdecken replies with, that's even better, I don't have anything against big women.
Oh my god.
I don't like
Vander
my,
Justin probably
I just don't want to have any Vanderdecken quotes on my list. I just can't.
It's true.
Thank you for representing.
Can you cut my name out from Christian's entire speech right there, please?
I'll refresh us with some random fisherman on the sidelines when Otohime comes back with that paper and is talking to them about how all she had to do. This guy simply goes, politics is complicated. Honestly, same.
Politics,
dude.
It is complicated though. Like, what the hell?
Honestly, same. Which is why I ignore it at any given opportunity.
Yet.
All right, I'll leave you off with one more, and hope that you guys still have room
something
to grow
left.
into your own. I feel like I didn't snipe nearly as many as I could have. But at the end, when Fukuboshi gets on the video snail and is talking to the entire Fishman Island, and at the end of his speech, he says this: someday, when everyone's hearts have had time to heal, let us dream of the sun together.
Ooh,
yeah. Mirroring a line that his mother gave earlier and has given many times before also. And god damn it, if this show doesn't stop using this orchestral soundtrack.
That's what I'm saying,
of all these goddamn sad moments. I'm tired of crying over the same over the same track. The audio orchestral music that they use for these types of moments gets me every fucking time. I swear
to God.
That's
what I'm saying, dude.
It's this one thing that they use for all of these moments. It has such good highs and lows in this song. God damn it if it doesn't fucking ring every bell inside my stupid lifeless heart.
Lifeless fucking cold dead soul.
It rings the sadness out of my masculine heart that I've pounded it down because society told me that I'm not allowed to have emotions as a man.
Oh,
and it brings them out of me forcibly.
Oh no, this is the next commentary.
Is this tragedy number three?
This is tragedy 3.0.
This is tragedy number three.
All right,
little did we know, tragedy number three was with us all along.
I'm off my rocker. I need to stop.
I'm gonna go next. I unfortunately didn't have time to write down quotes word for word, but the two. Well, Christian already mentioned, Fisher Tiger on his operating table. His speech there really just resonated with me. My other one is toward the end when Neptune has just locked himself in his room and is speaking to his minister. He goes on about how, he was a soldier and he's been in battle and stuff like that. And he expressed how, I've gone to war for, strangers and other things and like that. So why can't I be there in my wife's corner and fight for her? And that one hurt. That one really hurt. Yeah. He's like, why can't I raise my hand on my wife's behalf? Why is that not allowed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the survivor trauma is real. You got any others?
That's it for me.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, I mean, we have touched on it. I really got to reiterate how much I love the Fisher Tiger. Our hate must die with us. I think that is probably the most profound point in these set of episodes. And it comes back to the next generation has to learn to have the capacity for love and acceptance. If we can't do it, we have to provide the opportunity for the next generation to do it for us. And then Christian already touched on it. It was something that Otohime said. I love this line. where she, in her drunken state, mind you, but the words are what matter here, not the energy. She explicitly screams to her people, why is it that in a boundless ocean, in the darkest depths, 10,000 meters below the surface, do we choose here to call home? And the reason is because it's the one place on the ocean floor that gets sunlight from the surface. And they have every right to be able to experience that and the majesty of the world above for their race and their children, like any other race on this planet. And I vibe so hard with that. And I love everything about what her message there.
Justin said this, not me, but
fair enough. Well, no, you said that Fukuboshi mirrored that line or whatever when he was talking to
that part. Yeah.
Thank you for saying this. I did forget. This is the line I also wanted to mention. So thank you. Yeah,
Justin's the one who brought up the why kids want to go up to Shabundi Island and see the park and all that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I'll leave with those. Those are my two for these episodes.
I think what I appreciate about Otohime's line during her drunken rant is I think it really put a new perspective on her political position in all of this. You know, when her ideology is introduced, it just kind of seems like it's serving to humans in a lot of ways. Like, you don't see as much clear benefit on behalf of fishmen and fishmen alone. You know what I mean? It's a middle of the ground thing, serves for both sides, mostly human leaning, in my opinion. And then you get this speech where she's like, don't you want to have the capacity to just live anywhere the same way these people can? Like, we can physically live anywhere. We can breathe air. We can breathe underwater. Why are we secluding ourselves to this one tiny lit corner of the entire depth of the ocean? You know what I mean? I was like, okay, this puts a newfound perspective on her position. And I found it eye-opening and stuff like that.
These set of episodes really do round out her mission in a very meaningful way, in a way that we needed as an audience. And I think it was by design that we don't see that part of her until after Fisher Tiger meets his untimely demise. I think that it was on purpose that her idealistic nature came off as very non-serving to the fishmen, while Fisher Tiger was clearly the most serving of fishmen in fishman kind. And then after he passes, it wasn't until afterwards and the falling out that Otohime's true colors and true objectives become very known to the audience and to the rest of the islanders. That, hey, no, we need to dream to do something more. Oh, it's so good. I love it.
Yeah. And even though she didn't do it on purpose, I think it speaks volumes for the fish people that are all listening to this, that she is not in her usual state of being either. She's a sobbing, drunken mess right now, sitting on they don't see her, but she's sitting on the floor of her room amidst a pile of bottles. Very much unlike the image she gives off when she's in public, where she's standing above them on a crater or whatever, trying to preach to them about how they should go up to the surface and, you know, get on friendly terms with the humans. This sort of offers a more
vulnerable, maybe?
Yeah, vulnerable, relatable side to her that she wouldn't have normally done otherwise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think with that, unless you guys have anything else to throw onto the table, the nope. Golden Ham.
This is hard.
I feel
we're
like
on the same boat as last week.
Yeah, but I feel like the problem here is like we did give it to Otohime last week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm heartbroken because I almost
Can I give you guys something that I feel very strongly about for these episodes?
Go on.
Yes.
For the Golden Ham. Fisher
yes.
Tiger and Otohime are great.
Mm-hmm.
It would serve to reason that Otohime, out of the two of them, again would maybe, unless you vibed specifically with Fisher Tiger's point of view, Queen Otohime gets a bulk of these episodes dedicated to her,
mm-hmm.
and
yes.
feels more compelling to me personally. Again, like last week,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but
okay,
I really liked the three princes for their part during
wow.
the tragedy. I very much admire, I was originally, when the two, please remind, what was it, Momoshi and what was the other one?
Momboshi and Ryuboshi.
When those two turned around, and I mean, I said it before, but I feel like I need to reiterate it. When they turned around immediately and started trying to cheer up Shirahoshi despite their own sadness. Holy shit, dude. It was it felt so unbelievable because they're young kids too. Like they're not teenagers. They're not in their 20s. Like they're maybe in their early teens at most, you know.
Sure.
To be able to turn around and make that sort of decision in that situation is mind-blowing. It takes so much mental fortitude to be able to do something like that. And then I was ready to just give it to those two, but then Fukuboshi comes on at the end of these episodes and does his whole thing to the people after the funeral or during the funeral. And they're all in on it too, but Fukuboshi has always kind of been their
like the
spokesperson the voice of the three princes. It's crazy to me. It takes so much good character
maturity
exactly to be able to turn around and make a decision like that after just a couple of days of your mother being violently ripped away from you. And Shirahoshi's there too, of course, during that whole funeral thing. But I love it. I loved every second of it. I can't put it any other way.
I can vibe with this decision. I'm not against this. This feels all right. I'd be open to this. Justin, what say you?
Wow, my heart really breaks at the fact that we're not going to give Fisher Tiger Golden Ham at all, huh?
I know.
It hurts me too. Honestly, I didn't realize that we were only going to have two shots.
I really thought, if it wasn't last week, I really thought this week I could make an argument, but god damn it.
I thought I was gonna too, man. I forgot how much Onohime's story broke me. I also vibe a lot. I mean,
Fisher Tiger doesn't deserve to go without a golden ham, man.
Listen, these set of episodes are essentially, they're some of the episodes that make One Piece exactly what it is. And they're 10s out of 10s in their own right. Every single one of these characters are worthwhile and worthy of their own spotlight for the Golden Ham. On other weeks, I'm sure that Fisher Tiger would have 100% made the cut. Otohime would have made the cut on her own week. It just so happens that all of this played out tangentially in a single week. I think that we can just relish in the fact that all five of them are worthy. I'm willing to go with the boys this week, though. I can vibe with that.
Do what you must.
I take no pride in taking this away from you, Justin, but because Fisher does absolutely deserve this equally. But the I don't know, those kids, they really
spoke to him spiritually.
They struck a chord. I can't lie about it.
His big brother
about it. I'm just still sad of my own.
His older sibling senses got activated by these kids.
That could very much be true. That could very much be true.
It does happen. All right, we did it. It's the royal brothers. I don't know what you would call them. I guess princes. The Ryugu brothers.
I think they're usually called the three princes or just the princes, something to that effect.
Okay, the princes win. If somebody could write that into the sheet, because I'm away from my computer, that would be awesome. So we don't forget. Moving on to fan mail. There is none. Moving on to Patreon shoutouts. Dan Terrell, you're still our Patreon number one. Thanks, big guy.
Hell
look out for
yeah.
the. Look out for the what do you call it?
The
Speed Racer podcast
that's coming
out real soon.
Don't tell him that. Don't lie to him.
Don't lie to him.
Yeah,
we recorded it real quick. When it gets released, remains to be seen.
Moving on to the grab bag. All right, I finally have the bag in my possession. No thanks to any of you schmucks.
You're welcome.
All right, well, does anyone want to reach their hand into the bag?
I'm too sad.
Yeah,
all right, great. You know,
he's still upset. Let him sit there for a little bit. He's gotta work that out.
Fully right, expect the Fisher Tiger Gold Platinum Ham nomination. Not so distant future.
the Platinum Ham nomination. That's fine. I can do that. All right, I ruffled it up. Go ahead and Christian, reach your hand in.
Ruffled, you say? Like this?
Yeah, yeah.
Is this just
like I shook it up?
This is looks like a pillowcase. This is a pillowcase. You call this the grab bag?
What are you talking about? This
dirty
is the
grab
bag.
This ain't the grab bag.
All right. Well, okay.
Don't give me grab bag.
Because the grab bag you sent me was disgusting. I had to send it to the dry cleaner and I had to come up with something. All right. Like, what the hell, man? You don't have to tell them that. Remember, this is an audio based platform. You could have just skated on through. But no, you had to go ahead and tell them that I have a different bag today.
Well, how was I supposed to know that the snails would go bad before they got to you? I paid for overnight shipping. The package got lost. It's not my problem. Fucking
God. Of course they went bad before they got here. Are you new to this?
If they had overnighted like they were supposed to, they would have been fine. FedEx fucked up.
Even if you overnight them, you have to make sure that you bring in or put them with a bunch of fucking water so that they stay hydrated.
I
can't believe I have to tell you this. Oh my God. It's snacks, he says. All right, well, fine. So the cat's out of the bag. We don't have the grab bag, but either way, just fucking reach your hand to the stupid pillowcase. All right,
fine. You know what? Fine. Fuck. Here. Take it. You read. I don't even care
fine,
anymore.
I fucking will. Thanks. I appreciate it. All right, so now on my fucking fortune cookie looking. And your hands are all fucking greasy. What the hell, dude? Like, wash your hands.
I'm worked up, all right? This got me heated.
Well, I mean, I'm the one with the dead snails in a bag. All right. Like what the, at least I keep my fucking self clean. All right. Anyway, I'm reading this page. We have rain check this week. And the rain check that we have is, do you have a video game that you go back to again and again? That's a good question, actually.
I'll go first. So cheap cop out answer here is Smite, because it's a MOBA and you just replay them over and over and over and over and over and over again. Better well thought out ish answer is there were plenty of times growing up where like I got grounded and or I was just really, really, really bored. Like there's nothing on TV, there nothing online, whatever the case was, right? I could always reliably go back, turn on my DS Lite, Nintendo DS Lite, and play Kirby Squeak Squad and just run through
Kirby
the story
Squeak
in
Squad.
Like a couple hours. And just have fun playing Kirby and, you know, sucking up and using cool powers. My favorite part of that game was you could like mix powers, like certain powers together. So like, you know, if you ate a sword character and a fire character, you make a fire sword Kirby. You know, ice person with the tornado person, you made an ice tornado power. I always found that stuff really cool. I always try to mix and match different combinations. My favorite was Wheel Kirby, where you just turn into Sonic the Hedgehog, and if you ate like an elemental power, you would get the element too. So like ice Wheel Kirby could like make their own platforms. I really like that game. It was really cool. Lots of replayability for me for some reason.
Okay, fair enough.
Right. Let me tell you guys about the greatness.
Oh boy, here we go.
That is
I
am Mayo, baby. This game is the shit. Let me tell you.
I am Mayo. Is that what you said?
When I am Mayo.
Oh, I am Mayo. Oh my fucking God.
Let me tell you about the greatest clicker game you'll ever play in your life. You take
fucking
that
hell, dude.
You take that mayonnaise jar and you tap the shit out of it and you get so many goddamn costumes. It is the
best. You gotta stop.
Anytime,
dude.
I'm bored, I'm in there. You know. Golly. I'm clicking that jar with the cowboy hat on. Sheesh.
All right. Well, I mean, at least he's honest.
All right. So realistically, I've made it no secret that Bloodborne, I've even gone so far as to recommend it as one of my recommendations, is probably my favorite game of all time. I go back to that game at maybe once a year, twice on some occasions, to just go back and do runs whenever I could do a run. And then 6 months later, I'll get a random Reddit post just blasted to me by some random source. And I'll be like, damn, I should go do a run with X weapon now or this type of build this time, because it's just so much fun to just run through. It doesn't take, if you know what you're doing and you just want to beeline the story, it takes a couple of hours if you know what you're doing and you're good enough at the game to beeline the main story. Hit all the story bosses, find the weapon you're looking for, whatever it is. I just love everything about Bloodborne. It's got the aesthetic I love, the weapon combinations and choices you can use and implement are just mwah. So I go back to it all the time.
Facts. All right. Is that your pedestal?
Yeah, I'm good now.
All right. Well, I would say I'm probably a bit biased towards Nintendo based properties. I would say that of Nintendo games, the ones I play the most or replay the most are probably Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time. I played those to the point where I know limited knowledge on how to speed run them. Like I know how to do a popular glitch in Zelda called ISG, which is where you trick the game into basically having your sword constantly It has like a hitbox that's infinite, so you can just like walk around without flailing it, and it just like kills everything that that you touch. There's another glitch in the same game that's called SS or bomb super slide or something super slide. Basically, you put a bomb above your head, you roll into it last second, and then you can just like constantly slide backwards with your shield up. It's the funniest fucking thing, and you can clear the entire map in like 3 seconds with it. It's incredible. One of my favorite tricks. Same thing with Super Mario 64. There's less glitches, except for like, I guess the backwards long jump up like stairs and stuff, and more just like really cool movement, really fun. I have an emulator. I play them all the time whenever I feel bored. I know both games front to back beyond a shadow of a doubt. And then the only multiplayer game, I haven't played in a bit, but there was a period of time that I would play relentlessly and I didn't care how old it got. Left 4 Dead 2 still has a very special place in my heart. It was probably the only, I hazard to call it an FPS because it doesn't have ADS, or I'm sorry, aim down sight, but it's still technically a first person shooter, but well, it's the best.
We call those
first person shooter.
First person shooters. Ahead, yeah, they're first person shooters.
Yeah, they are first person shooters, but like, I think it gets a bad rap as a first person shooter because it doesn't have, like, accuracy is dependent on you're crouching and if you're standing, essentially, and then if you're moving, like, because it's got the CSGO style first person shooter, only unlike CSGO, it doesn't have ADS at all. So you can't adjust your accuracy by aiming down sights. You can only adjust it by crouching or stopping your movement. Regardless, I loved that game. I knew every map front to back. I used to play it as infected. I used to play it as humans all the fucking time. I could play against comms. I could play against people. Used to love the shit out of it. We should play it in our Discord one of these days. I would love that if we did like an 8-man Left 4 Dead 2. That would be fucking baller. It's honestly been a little over a year now since the last time I played it.
Does it go 8-man? I thought it was 6. I thought it was 6. I thought it was two playable monsters.
It's 4 monsters, 4 humans. And the best part about Left 4 Dead, and it's almost like none of these asymmetric like campaign or like asymmetric multiplayer games have fucking figured this out. If either side drops a player, AI fill in the void so that you're not left by yourself at any point, which is the best way to play it. I don't understand how a lot of these asymmetric gameplay loops or whatever, like with Evolve or now with Evil Dead that we played kind of recently. If you lose a player on the human side, for example, you just lose a player. You have no like fallback, no computer, no nothing. Same thing if you're the monster, because you don't have allies. It's really hard to like feel motivated to fight. I think that's why I like the Left 4 Dead formula more. I like having teammates. I think having teammates provides a better version than asymmetric, where you're just alone as the monster or whatever. That's another story for another time. I'm getting lost in the sauce.
very fair.
Sorry, but yes, I love Left 4 Dead 2. I go back to it all the time. Left 4 Dead 1 as well, but I do think that Left 4 Dead 2 is one of those games that only improved. So if I'm gonna play either, I might as well play Left 4 Dead 2.
Yeah, I don't think many people really talk about Left 4 Dead 1 after Left 4 Dead 2 came out. Let's go play Left 4 Dead 2. Nobody cares.
Yeah, dude, like it's the perfect, and it's got so many mods and stuff. So if you play it and you can download random fucking maps that, you know, maybe they have like an Ocarina of Time map just for fucking fun. Oh God, I love it. I love every bit of it. But yes, that's it.
Sorry, I have an addendum to my first recommendation. It's not I Am Mayo, it's My Name Is Mayo. In my passion, I mixed up two game titles. The I Am Bread is a totally different game.
Yeah,
totally different.
Totally different.
My Name Is Mayo. Right, well, that's what you're looking for. There's 3 of them, by the way. Go play all of them.
God damn it, I hate it.
Play is a strong word.
Yeah, I would say you're playing.
All right, well, at the risk of making this podcast last longer than it needs to, Justin, do you mind doing the thing where you run us out?
Devin, come back so you can do your job already. If you enjoy listening to us, thank you. And if you wish to reach out to us, you can do so on Instagram and Twitter at PandaSightings. If you wish to send us emails about anything and everything you want, feel free to do so at pandasightings@gmail.com. If you wish to financially support us out of the graciousness of your heart, we have a Patreon. And we also have a community Discord full of wonderful people who like to do wacky and fun stuff. You can go join them in it. Link to all that stuff is in the link tree that would be in the description of this podcast episode. They're also in the links in our bios on social media and all that good stuff. Thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you.
It's true.
We don't have a bit to go back to, so I guess this is just kind of where we ended.
I mean, we can make a bit now.
Do you want to make a bit now? What kind of bit should we make?
Probably one that cheers Justin up a little bit, because I think he's still a little too depressed about that Fisher Tiger not getting the Golden Ham thing. Yeah, see, he's
already... How about this? Why not, at the end of this, so this is what we'll do. We have a brand new award we can call it the silver lining, and we can give it.
If that ain't the most best effort award shit I've ever heard in my life.
We could give the Silver Lining Award to Fisher Tiger.
Silver Linings Award.
Is that okay?
This is a grab bag in the making. Hold on, I like this. We should discuss this.
We need to discuss this internally going forward. All right, well, great. I think that's it.
All right. Yeah, bye, people.